Everybody, get up! Everybody needs to understand that I'm more than simply a hype man for this rap group. Just like GEICO is more than just a company that can save you money. GEICO also has fast and friendly claim service, so they can help you when you need it most. And while I do love being a hype man, I also love reading for children's audiobooks. Like Little Bo Peep, she lost the sheep, and she don't know where to find them. Yo!
GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing real good. Well, you're
I got to say that it's not just me. My whole metro area, I'm in a city of joy right now. I am surrounded by unusually happy people. You know, I was out dropping things at the dry cleaner and picking things up at the store and stuff today, and there's just this little extra bounce in almost everybody's step, you know, except for like, you know, there are like a few people who live here who are, God help them, Steelers fans or whatever, but don't know if you heard, folks, but the Broncos won the Super Bowl yesterday, so here in the Denver area, that's kind of a big deal. It's gotten a certain amount of media attention.
We are doing our part to get the word out about that little contest. And,
In case people didn't hear, yeah, you know, there was actually a football game yesterday, and my home team won. So, just FYI, in case you,
that's awesome.
Hadn't heard. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it was a good game, pretty much all the way through, and and there's some things surrounding the Super Bowl, as always, that are, you know, sometimes bears mention. Lady Gaga an amazing job on the national anthem. I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, Roseanne Barr level, you know, disrespect or something. And that's not what she brought at all. And that was pretty amazing.
Well, she's just so out there, her persona, you know.
Right.
She could have done anything, and I wouldn't have been surprised, you know. Like, she could have shown up, like, in a vintage World War II nurse outfit or something like that and made it real cheesy or, you know, I mean, who knows what she's going to do, right? But, you know, she just, okay, so she had on some pretty sparkly eye makeup, but so what? You know, no big deal. She really did a straight up, and I thought, heartfelt rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. It was, I mean, you know, if she was faking it, she was faking it good because she really seemed to mean it.
Yeah, it was, and the musical talent behind that was, even if you doubted whether the girl has any talent, you know, that she's just, you know, all she does is just show up and be weird, and then that kind of laid that to rest, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I've always thought she had a pretty phenomenal voice, but never better applied than last night at the Super Bowl for sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, what'd you think of the? How'd you like halftime? One of your favorite bands, I believe, huh? Coldplay. Got the stage stolen from them, though.
Yeah, they kind of did. But it was pretty good. It was pretty good. And my kids love the commercials as much as anything else. So, you know, all these things just around the Super Bowl, you know. So.
It is just a big cultural phenomenon. And in fact, the Super Bowl has a little bit of relevance for our program tonight, so we won't dwell on it overmuch here at the opening of the show, because we're going to talk about tonight, we're going to talk about why the pessimists are wrong, and they are. This title, as I'm looking at it, reminds me once again, Stephen, that I just can't do link bait. You know, I want to, but I just can't do it, right? Because obviously, it should have been the pessimists are wrong, and we can prove it, right? Or
yeah, well,
the pessimists say something and crazy, you won't believe what happened next, right? You know, something.
Yeah, number six will shock you.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, we're trying to do the clickbait.
That's
here,
what
and
you
I
do
just
for link bait.
Yeah. Wow, that would have been right. Yeah. Why the pessimists are wrong. Number five will blow your mind. Yeah. You know,
that's
and
right.
It turns out number five is pessimists extrapolate present tense without accounting for how reliably markets adapt. Ooh, huh?
My mind is blown.
How's the mind blowing going? But, okay, but, you know, click worthiness of the words aside, that is our topic tonight. Why the pessimists are wrong, and we believe they are. It was inspired by an essay over on Motley Fool by one Morgan Housel, who it turns out writes the occasional piece friendly to our worldview over there. So good for you, Morgan. Keep up the good work. Quotes Matt Ridley from time to time, author of The Rational Optimist, one of my favorite books. And
right.
Housel does this piece, and he says, what's going on? Why is it that pessimism sounds so smart, especially when things are so good? And we know things are good. If you listen to this show, you know things are going pretty well in the world. We talked not that long ago about why 2015 was, in many ways, the best year ever to be alive on the planet. Things are not going badly at all, really, when you look at the big picture. And yet, the dark outlook, the bleak outlook, the art student angst outlook, for some reason, always seems to be the one that people take more seriously, that they give more credibility to, and I don't know, that they just, in some ways, just kind of like better, don't you think? I mean, there's something, is it the seductiveness of the dark side of the force? I don't know. What is it that makes pessimism so attractive to people? That's the topic that Housel takes on here. And before we dive into his list, Stephen, thoughts on that, just jumping in?
Yeah, you can't fix what ain't broke. And we by nature want to fix things, right? And so, you know, we look for the things that are wrong to try to set them right. And
pessimism gives us something to do, in other words.
So that's right. That's right. Uh-huh. And here's another thing. Imagine, you know, an ambitious leader or would-be leader. How can they credibly claim to be responsible for some success if credit is given to, you know, an organic bottom-up cycle of virtue rather than their top-down policy? You know, how can you get credit for something that's been improving since the, you know, dark ages? If you're a leader that's, you know, come to power in the last 4 or 5 years or something, you can't. So people don't ever point to that. Then they point to, you know, this is obviously because of this policy we put in place or this or that. And so I think that's one thing. It's just the good that comes about organically. People never point to the fact that it's organic. Nobody can get credit for that.
You know what, Stephen? That is brilliant. I never thought about that before, and I think you're absolutely right. If the world's getting better, then any good thing you do is part of that pattern, right?
Right.
If the world's this hellhole and everything's going to hell in a handbasket, then anything good you do is this, you know,
and it amplifies
how heroic you are.
Yeah. And so if something good happens in the middle of what everyone thinks is a hellhole, then you can take credit for the good thing, right?
Right.
But I think that may be part of it. And there's also this tendency. the older we get, now, unfortunately, we hadn't conquered aging yet, so that hadn't happened yet. So we can, but there's no need to be pessimistic about that either. You know, we talk about that all the time on the show. You know, hopefully that the problem of aging, you know, will be addressed within a decade or two, hopefully. But as people get older and their bodies break down, there's always a tendency to look back, you know, when they're feeling philosophical or whatever, to this golden age where everything was better. And, you know, kids always respected their parents. And, you know, the world was not as complicated and all this. And you know what? The real golden age was when their body, when our bodies were working optimally. You know,
right.
That's
when you felt,
you know,
better.
And,
yeah.
And we had felt better. You know, every morning when I woke up in the morning, I didn't, you know, I didn't hurt all over. And you know, and
life
I didn't
had
have to
more possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. The life was in front of me, and you know, all this other stuff, and I didn't have to wake up four times in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. You know, that's. I think there's a tendency as people get older to look back on a golden age and think, well, you know, things have gotten worse all along, and doggone it, these kids won't get off my lawn, and they and their music is terrible. You know, there's just that tendency, and in a way they're right, because for them, you know, things are worse because, you know, old age sucks. It just does.
Yeah.
And you know, and growing frail and old is not a fun process. And so I guess there's that may help explain pessimism, particularly among those who had a few birthdays, maybe.
I think those are both excellent reasons. I think that there's a lot of truth to both of those, especially that first one. I got to say, explains.
Yeah.
Something that we've talked about before that I've never had an explanation for it, which is, for whatever reason, pessimism is cool, right? There's something cool about being pessimistic, and there's nothing cool about being optimistic. And now I understand why. If you're cool, you are fostering an image, you're nurturing this image of yourself as, you know, generally aloof and off from other people and separate and all that kind of thing. And yeah, you need to become the goodness in the world, right? If the world's good, then you're not unique enough, right? So the world's got to be a big pile of crap, right? So that your goodness can really can really stand out there. That's amazing. I've been talking about this for you. See, that's why we got to keep talking about things, Stephen. We finally get to that when you know.
Well, you know, in a minute we're going to talk about Paul Ehrlich, and maybe I'm introducing it too soon. And so how that connects with that particular pessimist, we'll get into that in just a minute. So I'm teasing.
Okay, well, let's see if it fits into one of Housel's possible reasons why pessimism always sounds so smart. His first one is, optimism appears oblivious to risks, so by default, pessimism looks more intelligent. And my comment on that is, superficially, that's true. But I think, that is based on the kind of Pollyanna view of optimism. It's the suggestion that, pessimism is the worldview that considers risks, and optimism is the worldview that doesn't consider risks. If that's the binary you're drawing, then obviously, you know, pessimism is more intelligent because you should consider risks, and we should all be intelligent.
Well, think about it this way. Think of it this way. Let's just say that, you're this guy that's completely on the fence, and you're a completely impartial observer of optimists and pessimists, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you see on one side, well, the optimists, they think things are going pretty well, and the pessimists think it's going to hell in a handbasket. Which do I want to side with? The pessimist could argue that, the optimists, they've got their worldview, and maybe they're just as right as we are. But, hey,
right.
We're the ones that at least see the problems so that they can be addressed. And the guy that's sitting on the fence might just say, you know what, they're right. The pessimists are at least focused on the problems, whereas the optimist may not be quite as focused on the problems. And so they might tend to side with the pessimist. But here's the problem with that. just because you see a problem doesn't mean that the solution that you suggest is necessarily virtuous. In fact, it tends to be the other way around. We see a problem, and now we're going to, you know, we're going to solve it with this policy or that, and then, you know, and what comes from that? Rather than leaving it alone, and, you know, it sometimes we make it worse and, you know, or create a whole different problem. And so sometimes the optimists, you know, you would have been better off going with them. So, I don't know.
To me, the other part of this is, you know, it's just how you're going to define the terms. By an optimist, do we mean someone who believes that positive outcomes are more likely than negative outcomes? In which case, both optimists and pessimists can be looking at risks, but they're just valuing and discounting things differently, right? So the optimist looks at the situation and says, well, there's these risks and these positive outcomes. I believe that the positive outcomes outweigh the risks and will have precedence. Whereas pessimists, you know, look and they'll say, well, there's these risks and I don't know, you know, sometimes they focus on positive outcomes, but definitely the risks take precedence. So it's what you're invested in and what you're discounting. And I think to me the counterpoint to step one, optimism appears oblivious to risks, so by default pessimism looks more intelligent. I think we're going to reach an inflection point on this one. This is the turning point on our whole Pareto analysis that I talk about all the time. Because we're getting to the point where being oblivious to opportunities is as damaging as being oblivious to risks. Maybe it always was, right? But we're reaching a point as a species where there is like so much good stuff that is potentially possible that we could be making happen, that if we don't pursue it, we're depriving ourselves of everything. Just solving all the problems that need to be solved, but you know, moving to a much better end state than we ever could have been in before. Eventually, I think that optimism is going to become more closely aligned with realism, because people are going to start seeing these upsides. I think these upsides are going to start seeping through, and then people are going to look at that formulation a lot differently than they used to. Because it's true that if you subject yourself or your family to some grave risk because you think everything's going to be okay, you know, if you call that being an optimist, okay, I call that being an idiot, right? But at the same time, if you don't pick up on some fantastic opportunity for yourself or your family, you know, something that would have immensely improved the quality of their lives, right, just because you didn't want to think about it, you're an idiot there too, right? Like, either one of those positions is not smart. And I think we're going to reach a point where people are going to start to see that that not recognizing the value in the potential upsides can be even more damaging than not paying enough attention to the risks, because those upsides can take care of the risks, plus they provide a lot of other stuff too. So
I think it's my hope anyway. I think it's inaccurate to say that an optimist doesn't see the problems. It's just that they tend to focus on the opportunities. Well, let's imagine the guy on the fence again, or perhaps maybe we look at this as the president of the United States. We got three enemy armies on our borders, let's say, and so which general do we choose? Do we choose the general that says, "Mr. President, we can meet the enemy and defeat them," or do you choose the general that's crying, "It's game over, man! It's game over. We got no chance. You know, we're all gonna die." Which do you want? I mean, as president, I think I'm going to go with the general that has a plan for success, because optimist. He's not neglecting to see that there's these, you know, three formidable armies or something, but he's got a plan for overcoming these obstacles. So maybe that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. Anyway, I think it's true. I think that people consider pessimism more intelligent because of the risk factor and because of a misunderstanding of what it means to be to be optimistic. Let's look at the second one. Or I'm sorry, do any of your why the pessimists are wrong examples?
It doesn't really fall. I think we'd have a better opportunity to bring it up here later. But, yeah, go ahead. You still there, Phil? Hello? I'm going to remain optimistic that Phil is going to come back.
Me? I mean, I hope
there,
this is...
There you are. There you are.
Okay, good. I was talking the whole time saying, nope, still here. I wonder which one of us is being recorded. So, you know.
I said that I was optimistic that you would show back up again. So,
there
we are. So,
you see? The pessimists lose again. Anyway, I was just saying, I don't think any of my examples fit in very well with this one. So, we'll move on to the next one. Number two, pessimism shows that not everything is moving in the right direction, which helps you rationalize the personal shortcomings we all have. I don't see this as a big one, personally. I don't know. Although it could be that some people, this is a huge reason why they embrace pessimism. That just seems so, I don't know, sad. Right.
Yeah.
I'm a loser, so I'm gonna be a pessimist because that doesn't, you know, it means everybody else is a loser too. That's unfortunate if anybody feels that way.
Yeah. Well, let's imagine that we see that not everything is moving in the right direction. You know, America has an obesity problem. Let's see that.
Right.
And so so we look at the personal shortcomings we all have. Well, you know what? I'm obese myself. Who could better address that? Someone who might be optimistic that they could lose some weight and get healthier, or someone who just feels like, well, there's not much that can be done about this. I might as well get happy being overweight and just deal with the problem best I can. I think the optimist is better suited to address personal shortcomings. They can see that, hey, yeah, I've got maybe this issue or that issue, but I can address that. I can move towards this opportunity by maybe changing a couple things in my life, or going and getting an education, or I can do some things to take advantage of an opportunity.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I think what you're giving is the rational right answer, right? But this idea that people actually adopt pessimism because they're obese and it's easier to be a pessimist and think everything's crap than think you might be able to do something about your own situation. Actually, you know what? With that example, yeah, I totally believe this one. I think that probably a lot of people do exactly those kinds of things. That's too bad. But, you know, I guess it's human nature. You know, something about, I don't know, it's related to sour grapes, I guess, in a way, right?
Yeah.
Things weren't going to work out anyhow, right? So, interesting.
This next one kind of focuses on the same thing, Phil. Number three, pessimism requires action, whereas optimism means staying the course. Not at all. Not at all. Pessimism would lead to inaction. If you feel like there's not much to, you know, hey, I've got, you know, there's, what's the point? You know, everything's crap. Whereas an optimist will recognize the issue and will not just stay the course. So.
Yeah, but I can see where an awful lot of pessimism is predicated on the whole we're the smart people who can fix the world. Okay.
Right.
And you dreamers who think things are going to get better on your own are deluding yourselves. That's why we've got to step in. And in fact, I don't know. Does the Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon thing fit here, actually?
It does, in fact. It does. Let's talk about that. So Paul Ehrlich became well-known for a 1968 book, The Population Bomb.
Right.
The Population Bomb said, basically, we're filling the world with too many people. The world can't possibly sustain all that. We're going to, you know, lead to mass starvation, followed by population crash and dark ages. Okay, and so what did he do, Phil? He suggested first voluntary population control, and then if that didn't work, He suggested mandatory population control.
Boy,
and of course,
when,
yes, and of course, when China adopted their one-child policy, it just made him smile. That was what it was all about for him. So, China has now abandoned that. I wonder how he feels about that now. But anyway, I went to I did some deep research on this, Phil. I went to Wikipedia.
Okay.
And just clicked on honors for this guy.
Okay.
And John Muir Award of the Sierra Club, Gold Medal Award of the World Wildlife Fund International, MacArthur Prize Fellowship, the Crayford Prize awarded by the Royal Swedish Academy, and it goes on and on and on. Volvo Environmental Prize, Distinguished Scientist Award of the American Institute of Biological Sciences, 2001. Here, Fellowship of the Royal Society of London in 2012, 2013, Foundation Frontiers of Knowledge Award in Ecology and Conservation Biology. Years after the purported, end of the world that he talked about in the population bomb failed to materialize.
Right.
And, the awards just keep coming in, you know.
Let me read you this quote from the Rational Optimist that Housel had on his blog over on Motley Fool, because I think this sums it up perfectly. It says, if you say the world has been getting better, you may get away with being called naive and insensitive. If you say the world is going to go on getting better, you're considered embarrassingly mad. If, on the other hand, you say catastrophe is imminent, you may expect a MacArthur Genius Award or even the Nobel Peace Prize, right? And that's
think he was referring specifically to Paul Ehrlich. Yeah.
Yeah. And all this in the face of the fact that he's wrong consistently. One of his great quotes before we get to the Julian Simon wager is, if I were a gambler, I would take even money that England will not exist in the year 2000. Okay, so should have bet.
Man.
Somebody should have bet him on that one. Here we are, 2015. Looks like England is still pretty much there. And one of the things that's funny about this is there is very little accountability in this world of predicting gloom and doom. You look at his books, and he says, massive famine in India and Africa by 1975, tens of millions dead, it's going to spread into Asia. And basically, he had predicted by earlier than where we are in time now, probably around that year 2000 or even earlier than that. The whole world is pretty much devastated by famine, and probably Latin America gets hit too. Probably North America and Western Europe are all that's left of the world at that point, right? So
right.
That was wrong. but it was pessimistic, so it was taken seriously. And again, for whatever reason, you don't get held accountable. But Julian Simon, who among many other accomplishments in his distinguished life, was the co-author of one of the greatest books ever written. It's getting better all the time. Decided to have a bet with Paul Ehrlich, and in 1980, they decided. They had gone back and forth on what the bet would be. But they decided to go with the concept of resource scarcity, and they would do it over a decade, because obviously Paul Ehrlich is saying everything is getting more expensive, resources are becoming less available. You can pick any five expensive resources today here in 1980, and by 1990 they're going to be off the charts expensive. So they actually picked copper, chromium, nickel, tin, and tungsten, and Simon bet that the price of those things would go down. Ehrlich bet that they would increase, and, obviously we wouldn't be telling this story probably if it hadn't worked out the way it did, but Ehrlich lost big on this bet, right? That, in fact, all of those went down in price, and Julian Simon got paid, right? Ehrlich ended up having to write him a check. So it was kind of the one time that he, there was kind of a price to pay for being wrong. However, if you read about this, going back to the font of all knowledge, Wikipedia, if you read this story anywhere, everyone's quick to say, oh, but if you'd picked another 10-year period, Ehrlich would have won. Everybody is so quick to defend Ehrlich all the time, right? It's like, well, the pessimist was, you know, he was probably right. The guy was so wrong so many times, and he was wrong on this one. But there's this immediate natural, I don't know, desire to defend really an indefensible record on human achievement. And I wonder if it does go back to exactly that idea that you know, if things are going okay, there's nothing for you to fix, there's nothing for you to do. But if things are going to hell in a handbasket, well, you can make a whole career out of it, right? And you can get all kinds of accolades,
right,
and awards. Yeah,
you can. And
pessimism requires action.
Right, and particularly if there's no accountability for your predictions not turning out, and worse even than no accountability for predictions that fail to materialize, no accountability for the terrible things that your policies bring about.
Right.
You know, the one-child policy, which was directly influenced by Ehrlich's thinking, okay, in China, that one-child policy created a situation where if you can only have one child and, people wanted to have sons, then they would tend to abort fetuses that they knew were girls or adopt them out. And, you know, so many girls that would have been in China are now in the United States and elsewhere having been adopted.
Yep.
You know, and so what do you end up with? You end up with a country that's predominantly male, and they're looking around when it comes.
Yeah,
you got a huge woman shortage over there, and that creates all kinds of societal problems. And that's the big reason that they're abandoning the one child policy.
Yeah.
So.
And oh, what was I going to say about this? I was agreeing with you. Well, it's just this. When I look at this, to me, Paul Ehrlich is he's almost kind of a poster boy for getting it wrong. If he weren't taken so seriously, it would almost be comical, right?
Right.
How badly he has predicted the future. But as long as he keeps saying it's going to be bad, he keeps getting a pass. But I'll say this about Paul Ehrlich. He is a favorite among, you know, some of our conservative and libertarian friends, right? Because he's associated with China's, you know, one-child policy. But also, he's associated with kind of a mindset that goes with the more liberal/progressive sets of policies, right? So people look at Paul Ehrlich and they say, well, see, that's the kind of nonsense that you buy into. And the first thing you know, you got government doing everything and blah, 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 yada, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, maybe. Okay, yeah. Maybe so. In fact, I'd say probably so in the case of certainly something like China's one-child policy. But I want to point out that it also comes from the other side, that pessimism is not limited to the left or the right. This is definitely the pessimism of the left, but there's a pessimism on the right too. And I was really reminded of it when I read that that quote from Ehrlich when he says that England will not exist in the year 2000. Well, you know who that reminded me of? I thought, well, that sounds a lot like Mark Stein, right? I mean, if you read any of his stuff, he'll tell you that Europe won't exist, you know, as we've known it by the year 2030 or 2040 or 2050. And the very pessimistic take on demography and, you know, what's occurring there with the immigration and all those kinds of things.
The presidential candidates of the past, like Buchanan, would say things that are often pessimistic, at least as on the right, as Ehrlich is on the left. I wanted to contrast Ehrlich with an optimist. That I believe is more responsible probably for Ehrlich's predictions, not coming true, than probably any other single individual. Norman Borlaug, I may be mispronouncing this great man's name.
Borlaug, I always say, but whatever. Yeah.
Right. He is the father of the Green Revolution. He's also called the man who saved a billion lives. And what he did among many things that he did, was create a dwarf wheat hybrid that would mature faster and have greater yields in a shorter amount of time, allowing additional crops in the same growing season on the same ground. So you could harvest twice, you know, because instead of growing a long stem, the wheat would grow the head of the wheat where all the food is quickly, and it was it led to a revolution in agriculture. And I mean, the funny thing is, this agriculture took place almost around the same time as the population bomb was being was being written and published. The solution for the problem that Ehrlich was highlighting in his book was already in the works at the time that he published his book. In many ways, it saved the world. We did not have the food shortages because, we had some smart people. And that's the way it is. If you look at a certain trend and you say, if this trend continues, then it's just going to be doom and gloom. But the thing is, the trend, which is, people being born, that's not the only trend that's going. We got other trends as well, and some of it is, hey, we're learning better ways to make more food, and the pessimists often fail to see the good things that are happening because all they see is the crap. So
yeah, well, and in fact, there's a couple of things there. When you continue to extrapolate something, history has shown us there's no reason necessarily to assume anything is going to continue, that anything is going to stay the same, much less continue at a particular rate, right? Everything is subject to most trends, at least in human behavior and in civilization, are subject to slowing down, speeding up, and going in completely different directions. This actually goes to why I got my Super Bowl prediction wrong. Because if you'll recall, what I said was going to happen was, if you look at the record, the Broncos usually get blown out. So chances are they'll get blown out. But if they win, they'll win in a squeaker. Well, in fact, neither of those things happened, right? They didn't get blown out, yay. And it really wasn't much of a squeaker either. It was a pretty decisive victory. Why did I get it wrong? Well, two things. One is I made I made data points into a trend that had no bearing, right? Other teams in other decades had been blown out. It had absolutely nothing to do with
No single individual that played in those games was playing in last night's game.
Well, I mean, there were several who played in the blowout from 2 years ago, but even that, it's a significantly different team. And the rest of the blowouts, none of those people are the same, absolutely.
Right.
So that's not really a trend that has any bearing at all. And the other trend, the more subtle trend that was occurring, was everyone was watching Carolina and their offense just getting better and better and more powerful and, peaking with that NFC championship where they just buried Arizona. It was just this incredible tour de force offensive performance with some help just by Arizona messing up pretty bad. But what's happening meanwhile, this other trend, this counter trend going on that people aren't paying quite as much attention to, is the Denver defense, which had been awesome all season, suddenly really poured it on in the postseason. And, their performance against Pittsburgh and then against New England was like a notch higher than anything you'd seen all season. It's like somebody smart might have said, well, gee, what if they take it up one more notch for the Super Bowl, which is exactly, of course, what happened. And then you have a completely unprecedented kind of a game where it's like it doesn't matter how awesome you're.
They peaked at the right moment then, didn't they?
Yeah,
they,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you can get yourself into a lot of trouble trying to project from trends that don't necessarily mean anything, and by missing trends where the real, the real guts of the matter lie. In fact, one of my examples, And since you brought up Borlaug, we have to talk about this now, is Malthus, right? Because Borlaug was
right.
The ultimate disproving of, you know, this economist from the 1700s, you know, who just laid it out in real simple mathematical terms. He said, look, population growth outpaces food production. So eventually we're going to have too many people and everybody's going to starve. I mean, and it was, you know, as sound as it could have been at the time. And what it didn't take into consideration is that although population may continue increasing at the same rate or may speed up, may accelerate significantly, he didn't take anything into consideration around how might food production change over time. Right. To him,
right.
That was a constant. You know, the rate at which we could produce food was always going to be a constant. Kind of like me, I was thinking that the Denver defense was kind of a constant. No, that was a changing variable too. And Borlaug is the, you know, the awesome example of that in the 20th century, where it's like, well, actually, you can produce a lot more food. You can produce tremendously more food than we ever thought possible before, to the point where a couple of stats from. Another one of Housel's blogs. In 1900, 44% of all American jobs were in farming. Today, around 2% are, right? So that's the, you know, and people are obviously much better fed, and there's a lot more food available today than there was in the past. So even without looking at Norman Borlaug, you just look at it and go, you know what, we got a lot better at producing food. Malthus was bound to be wrong because, you know, he didn't take those kinds of those kinds of trends in common, into consideration when he made his prediction. And I think that is why the pessimists are wrong. You know, they miss that every time, that more than one variable in the formula can change. And the one that has changed, our ability to produce food, has made all the difference, hasn't it?
It has. And one thing that, you know, you might think, well, we peaked on food production. We hadn't come close to peaking on food production. There's so many things that can be done and is just almost within our grasp to revolutionize food production again. You know, our friend Philippe von Netterveld, who's been on this show and his predecessor show as a guest in the past, pointed to an article on, what is commonly referred to as bat meat, but
yep.
It's not. It's
that's
it's,
vat with a V, Victor.
Yeah,
Victor.
V.
Not bat, as in Batman, but
yeah.
Vat as in a vat of meat. Yes,
that's
sorry,
right. And in this, it showed they cloned. The muscle cells of a particular animal. I think it was a cow, and they made a meatball. And you know, this was probably a $10,000 meatball. You know, and they had a chef who you know, fixed it up and everything. And a young woman sat there and ate it. She's going, "This is good. It's not bad." That is the first time I've ever seen food that was produced in that fashion, eaten and enjoyed. Now, people have eaten previous efforts to create meat that way, and it
right.
was not good. It was not good. I mean, you know, it was described as having the consistency of a tumor. You know, it was just
right.
It was it's not what you want to eat. Well, this was not bad. This was, in fact, she said, "Hey, this is quite good. This is pretty good." So, you know, imagine if we can get that up to speed. So, you know, you no longer have the production of greenhouse gases caused by, you know, cow flatulence, and you no longer have these terrible for the environment feedlots, and you don't have to grow a whole cow to get just the complete with skeletal structure and digestive organs and brain and, you know, all the things that you don't need for food, right? All you're
right.
growing is the food.
Right.
And so the inputs into that process are like, you know, one-tenth of the inputs to get the same amount of meat from a cow. And so if this could be scaled up and brought to market, and it was good, Phil, and it was and priced at a price that's reasonable. Don't you think that everybody would jump at this? I mean, I don't know any as much as I love meat, I don't love the fact that animals have to die so that I can have meat. That's not what I love
right.
about meat. You know?
Right.
I like a great steak, not the fact that some poor cow died to give me that great steak. So if you can put a great steak in front of me, or a meatball or whatever.
The real ethical dilemma around eating meat these days is that what efficiencies they could add to the process have just made it harder and harder on the animals, right? The whole factory farming thing, the best they could do to make it more efficient has been at cost of quality of life to the animal, to the point that, enough said.
We could do
a show every week about how terrible that is. But here's something that just sidesteps that completely, right? No animals suffer. In the production of this, so you have this tremendous environmental benefit. You've got this tremendous energy savings. You would have this huge yield, similar to what Borlaug, provided with grain.
And the icing on the cake is this moral, thing. I mean, we tend to be as moral as we're capable of being. We tend to become as good of people as we can be, as we can afford to be, and so, hey, if we can afford to be better people and not kill animals, kill our fellow creatures here on Earth in order to have that great steak and that and the awesome meatball that girl was eating, that's good and so much better for the environment at the same time, and so people are going to jump at that as soon as this is scaled up. I have every reason, I have every belief that that's going to happen. I am optimistic about that, Phil. So
am I. And those kinds of things.
I believe I've lost you again, Phil. Hello? Hello?
That
Hello?
They will continue.
Okay. I am back.
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yes.
Okay, good. I was monologuing.
Happening.
Yeah. I heard you say you couldn't hear me, and then you disappeared completely. So anyway, this is our two glitches of the week. But being the optimist that we are, we feel that the show is.
We're gonna press forward. Yeah.
Only gonna get better and better. Okay, so we got a couple more of these. We got to hit them quickly, because I know we got more examples. Optimism sounds like a sales pitch, while pessimism sounds like someone trying to help you. I feel that is really closely related to the third one, and that, Paul Ehrlich would be the first to tell you that he's just trying to help people, right? whereas Julian Simon was just giving a sales pitch for how things are getting better all the time. And number five, pessimists extrapolate present trends without accounting for how reliably markets adapt. So I think that's that's it in a nutshell, right? That's the piece that we've been hitting on consistently. People see what a pessimist will project, and they say, "Yep, that looks like a reasonable extrapolation of where things are going." But it's not reasonable because you're not looking at everything else. And I think we got a great example of this around computer chips, don't we?
Right. Yes, and the example is this. Let me see if I can pull it right up here. Article in Game Debate says Intel vice president calls effective end to Moore's law with focus on efficiency over performance. Basically, it's reached a point, Phil, that it would be difficult to shrink their processes of to make a integrated circuit, because making these devices smaller, you begin to have, at some point, you reach the atomic limits of what these things can do without electrons jumping from one circuit to the next, right?
Yes. We're not really all that close to that, I don't think, but. I think the reason they're stopping is because it's become so energy intensive that there's not really a market for it. They're not getting any value for money by continuing Moore's Law at this point. That's the way I read it anyway. I may have misunderstood.
And so, you know, what is their answer? Well, we're going to work on efficiency. We're going to offer the same level of computation with less energy requirement. And so, what we may offer if you need more power in your laptop, you're going to be drawing this. You can plug in your laptop and it'll draw the same power as last year's model, but it'll give you more computation because we've worked on that efficiency issue. And so that's their way of looking at that. But you could look at that as a pessimist and go, hey, this is just nothing but bad news. If Moore's Law, which has been delivering for us for years, since even before Gordon Moore noticed the trend and put his name on it, then that's over. Then that's just terrible. This has been something that's been kind of propping up Western civilization for the last generation or so. Is how you could spin this as a pessimist and say, now it's just game over. We're dead. No, but here's the thing. Integrated circuits, and that's all Moore's Law was about. It's always been about just, integrated circuits, the amount of transistors we can put on an integrated circuit, and we can increase that by shrinking these components. And we've been doing it over this period of time, and so we get more and more power, more and more computation for in the same space. And so that's what Moore noticed. That was a paradigm, a computational paradigm that replaced vacuum tubes. And before vacuum tubes, it was other things. We've had computation paradigm after computation paradigm. It was relays, then vacuum tubes, then integrated circuits. Maybe you could even say vacuum tubes and transistors by themselves, and then the transistors integrated onto a integrated circuit. So it's as each of these paradigms comes to an end, invariably another paradigm arises to give us something else to exploit to increase our ability to compute. Phil, what is the replacement? What is the potential replacement on the horizon?
Well, it's great. I was looking back over transcripts I've done of our interviews with Ray Kurzweil on this point. When we've spoken to Ray about this, because he's always the first to tell you, Moore's Law reaches it reaches an inflection point on standard microprocessor chips. He always said it was probably going to be in the 2020s sometime. So I don't know if he would buy into the fact that that they've hit the wall quite yet. Anyway,
the wall is close.
One of the transitional technologies he always talked about was making them 3D, right? Which is what you get when you get the GPUs, these graphical processing units, these super powerful chips that they're using to do all this machine learning stuff at Google. And in fact, there's just been a story on Tech Times. MIT has built a low power AI chip for mobile. So one of the things that's happening is that this focus on making things more efficient is suddenly distributing incredibly powerful processing power much more broadly than it would have been available before, because this, suddenly we're going to have on our phones these GPU chips that are capable of doing this incredible machine learning type, advanced AI type stuff that's currently going on at these big servers at Google and places like that. So the applications will continue to be developed, right? I mean, we're not going to notice this immediate, oh, no, it's over, we're not getting any more processing power for our money. But what Ray always said was going to happen after that is quantum computing, right? That ultimately it's going to show up and it's going to, completely change the game. He also talked about the fact that, there's things you can do with nanotechnology. You can, down at the molecular scale, that ultimately, you can keep making smaller and smaller chips down to the Planck scale, right? We don't have the technology for that yet, but theoretically, you can ultimately get there. But even if you look at this this piece that you sent to me earlier, Stephen, that talked about the fact that it's going to shut down, a passage from that piece says, looking forward, Holt anticipates further performance gains will be made when quantum tunneling establishes itself. In the short term, this means a reduction in performance, but the eventual shift could represent a gigantic leap in performance when it does eventually arrive. And if you look, do a Google search, folks, on quantum computing and Moore's Law, and you'll see across the board, you know, Wired has been talking about this, Slate's been talking about this, Google has been talking about this. Everybody anticipates this handoff to a completely new paradigm sometime in the next few years. So, you know, I look at this and I say, well, we may hit this flat point for Moore's Law, you know, because we've had this wonderful, the number of microprocessors doubles every 18 months for, you know, that's been going on basically, Stephen, your whole lifetime, right? I mean, this has been, you know, an effective law you could count on. We may go 10, you know, 18-month periods where nothing doubles. You know, 15 years it might take before this stuff really kicks in. But when it does, when quantum tunneling really becomes an applicable technology, you know, we're not talking about a doubling. We're talking about a hundredfold or multiple hundredfold increase in processing power that's going to occur. So any blip we see in Moore's Law will probably be erased right in the first generation of the new technology, and then no telling how fast it's going to grow after that. So, yeah,
well,
there's
another thing,
yeah,
Phil, and why I think that when it comes down to you know, our ability to use computation that keeps growing and growing and growing, I think let's just imagine that you know, we do have a 15-year period ahead of us, Phil, where we see, you know, no ability to make more computation. You know, Moore's Law just craps out on us. We don't have anything new come along to help with that. What does that do for us personally? Well, we all have, you know, we all carry now in with us everywhere we go these little computers we call smartphones, and the computation that brings into our life is not limited to computation that's actually in your pocket, Bill. It's the fact that it touches computers, server farms that are doing, you know, you ask your phone to tell you, you launch the Wolfram Alpha app on your phone. It's not doing the computation there locally, is it, Phil? So
no, of course not.
All of our devices, could continue to grow in capability, not because of necessarily the computation right there locally on that machine, but because of what it touches, the cloud, and you know, these server farms can continue to grow and get bigger, and offer more computation and more capability, even if we hit a period where Moore's Law just doesn't deliver anymore.
Yeah, and again, we're gonna have GPU chips on our phones, right? So they're gonna become incredibly powerful anyway. Plus, the other side of it is, software development becomes more powerful. Even if the chips stay the same, we get better at developing software and the programs become more powerful. So, you know what? There is just so much to be excited about how cool computing is going to be in the next few years. I am not the least bit shaken by this Moore's Law news. I got to tell you, you kind of threw me for a loop this morning when you sent me that, Stephen, but I'm over it now, now that we've talked through it. I'm feeling very, very, very optimistic. We gotta talk about our music before we do. Oh, actually, go ahead. What's our music tonight?
Our music is "Joyful People" by Dean Kadam.
Well, that is us. We are joyful people. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. We will be back next week, next Monday evening, with an all-new show. We're going to be talking to our good friend Jim Elvidge. You don't want to miss that show because we're going to get into some really, really interesting stuff. As you know, Jim is a little bit out there talking to us about how we might be living in a computer simulation and related observations to digital reality. Look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.
If you own a small business, it's not a question of if some hacker is going to attempt to attack your company. It's a question of when. Let cyberpolicy.com keep you safe. CyberPolicy is the first end-to-end solution that combines cyber planning, security, and insurance. With CyberPolicy, your business will be protected against cyber attacks for as little as 40 cents a day. Visit cyberpolicy.com today and get a quote in just 4 minutes. CyberPolicy.com.